Montana's food banks expect a huge increase in demand if federal legislation to cut food stamps becomes law. Good evening, I'm Connor Ballantyne.
And I'm Courtney Anderson, and Capitol reporter Dan Boyce has our top story tonight on Montana Evening Edition.
We'll also tell you why environmentalists want federal protection for fishers, which are members of the weasel family. And in our feature interview, news director Sally Mock talks with an expert in international law about the American response to the use of chemical weapons in Syria. Before we get to our first story, we have this breaking news. Missoula police are engaged in a standoff with a man who refuses to come out of a trailer house on Missoula's north side. The Missoulian reports at one point this afternoon the man shot at an armored vehicle sent into the alley near Cooley and Burns Streets to provide a phone line into the house. A woman may be inside the home as well. Cooley Street is closed between Byron and Burns because of the incident. Now for our top story. A bill to cut the federal food stamp program by $4 billion annually over the next decade is heading over to the U.S. Senate. Food stamps are now referred to as SNAP benefits, standing for the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. The Republican-led U.S. House passed the SNAP cuts last week over opposition from Democrats. Capitol reporter Dan Boyce says in Montana the proposed cuts could seriously impact local food banks.
Executive Director of the Great Falls Community Food Bank, David Abbott, says currently about 10,000 people in Cascade County do not know where their next meal is coming from.
I mean, we're talking about people who are unemployed, the elderly, single moms.
He says his food bank has given out 804,000 pounds of food so far this year. He predicts the number of people who look to use the food bank and the amount of food he will need donated from the community will double if federal cuts to SNAP go through.
We do a pretty decent job of getting food out, but obviously that's going to be a major strain on what we do. It's going to be a real challenge.
The Montana Department of Public Health and Human Services facilitates SNAP in the state, and DPHHS says Montana receives $190 million in SNAP benefits per year. Those who receive the benefits include 55,000 children and 9,000 seniors.
It is an important safety net for families, children who are in need.
That's Montana's Congressman Steve Daines. He joined House Republicans in voting for the cuts to SNAP. Daines says, yes, SNAP is important, but here's the challenge the country faces.
In 2006, the spending on food stamp was $33 billion.
Fast forward to this year, the original SNAP funding bill had grown to $82 billion.
In other words, the food stamp spending is up 150% in the last 7 years.
Dane says the SNAP bill passed by House Republicans shaves off 5% from that 150% increase.
It's not that we're going to have the truly needy here seeing their benefit cut. We're going to see a ability here to save some dollars here because there are some people out there who are gaming the system and there's fraud in the system today.
Great Falls Community Food Bank Executive Director David Abbott says SNAP has been growing at such a rate because people are still having a hard time making a living in the aftermath of the Great Recession. He says for those who are finding work, many continue not making enough to get by.
So you still seek help from elsewhere to have food on the table.
Abbott says Congress needs to really think hard about the impacts these cuts will have. The Congressional Budget Office estimates almost 4 million people would lose SNAP benefits next year under the proposed cuts nationwide. NPR reports the chair of the Senate Agriculture Committee, Michigan Democrat Debbie Stabenow, says the bill will never see the light of day in the Senate. I'm Dan Boyce, reporting at the Capitol.
Dan will be speaking more with Congressman Daines on the proposed SNAP cuts and his bill to increase the timber harvest on national forest land in a feature interview tomorrow during Montana Evening Edition.
And in other news from around the state, a General Electric Company subsidiary wants a federal judge to reconsider this month's ruling, blocking it from trucking giant oil field equipment on winding Idaho Highway. The company today filed an appeal in U.S. District Court in Boise, saying Judge B. Lynn Windmill commented serious errors of law and fact when he blocked its so-called megaloads from traveling U.S. Highway 12's federally designated Wild and Scenic River Corridor. Windmill halted the shipments, at least until Nez Perce Clearwater National Forest managers assess impacts of the 225-foot-long, 640,000-pound water evaporator on the route before consulting with Nez Perce tribe over its concerns. The GE unit, which has said it could lose millions if its equipment doesn't arrive at northern Alberta's tar sands on schedule, says it's facing imminent and continuing irreparable harm.
Environmental groups are petitioning the federal government to enact endangered species protections for the Northern Rockies fisher. The member of the weasel family lives in old-growth forests along the Montana and northern Idaho border and preys on porcupines, snowshoe hares, and other animals. Six groups filed the petition today with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to designate the predator as an endangered or threatened species. A similar petition was rejected in 2011 after federal wildlife officials determined trapping, logging, and residential development did not appear to be hurting populations. Tierra Curry of the Center for Biological Diversity says trapping has increased since then, and new research has emerged on the fisher's habitat. The Fish and Wildlife Service has 90 days to make an initial finding on the petition's merits.
The Idaho State Police says a Canadian man has died in a weekend motorcycle crash near Thompson Pass on the Montana-Idaho border. The ISP says 46-year-old Patrick M. Ryan of Calgary, Alberta, failed to negotiate a curve on Montana Secondary Highway 471 west of Thompson Falls on Saturday afternoon. He died at the scene. The crash is still under investigation.
A 54-year-old Whitefish man died after his pickup truck hit a tree east of Whitefish. The Montana Highway Patrol says the man was speeding and failed to negotiate a right-hand turn at about 9:30 Saturday night when he struck the tree. He died at the scene. The man's name hasn't been released.
Montana Grizzlies safety Matt Hermanson appeared in Missoula Justice Court this afternoon to face misdemeanor criminal mischief charges, according to KPAX TV. The 21-year-old football player was arrested at around 1:30 a.m. yesterday after allegedly damaging two signs in the Fort Missoula area. Authorities say Hermanson was alone when he broke a wooden Fort Missoula sign and bent a speed limit sign using his hands and feet. The investigating officer said Hermanson was intoxicated and slurring his words. He provided a breath sample, which registered at 0.185. Hermanson told officers he was out with friends, drank too much, and somehow ended up alone. He admitted that he broke the signs. Hermanson also had a warrant from the city of Missoula for a $114 speeding ticket. Hermanson is a junior from Sioux Falls, South Dakota, and is currently UM's second leading tackler.
Three men who have served as superintendent of Yellowstone National Park say the park will always need advocates. Former Yellowstone superintendents Bob Barbie and Mike Finley joined current superintendent Dan Wink for a fireside chat on Saturday with several hundred members of the Greater Yellowstone Coalition. The Jackson Hole News and Guide reports the three said that although the park is healthy in many respects, there are looming threats to its integrity. Among the problems is decimation of the native cutthroat trout population by exotic lake trout. The three spoke at a convention in West Yellowstone, Montana, on Saturday, celebrating the 30th anniversary of the conservation organization. They said park managers alone may not be able to defend Yellowstone adequately and said support from outsiders is critical.
Health officials in Oregon and Washington say people should protect themselves against mercury and PCB contamination by limiting consumption of certain fish species from a 150-mile section of the Columbia River. The advisory issued today applies to fish that live year-round between Bonneville and McNary dams, including bass, bluegill, yellow perch, crappie, walleye, carp, catfish, suckers, and sturgeon. It does not apply to migratory fish such as salmon and steelhead. The Oregon Health Authority and the Washington Department of Health recommend eating no more than one meal per week of resident fish species from the affected zone. They recommend not eating any fish taken between Bonneville Dam and Ruckle Creek, 1 mile upstream. Officials say they're unsure how long the advisory will last.
An organization offering support and educational fly fishing retreats for women with breast cancer holds a fundraiser in Hamilton early next month. Registration for the event is now open. The nonprofit, Casting for Recovery, provides free retreats to help women dealing with breast cancer. The program uses counseling, medical education, and fly fishing to provide what's described as an unforgettable experience. Women at any age and any stage of treatment and recovery from breast cancer are eligible. Applicants are selected through a lottery process. Program Director Peg Miskin says the Vermont-based Casting for Recovery hosts 42 retreats held in 34 states, two of them held here in Montana. Miskin says there's a reason the program is centered around fly fishing.
CFR actually began with the concept of the casting motion being good for soft tissue rehabilitation after a woman has had breast cancer surgery, but it has branched way beyond that. And for those of you who fly fish, knowing that being in nature and being in the moment on the stream can be very healing, and that is what happens at our Casting for Recovery retreat.
Miskin adds it's nice to get these women out of a clinical medical setting.
In fact, 70% of the women who come to our retreats have never been in a support group, and actually 95% have never picked up a fly rod. So instead of being in a support group setting in a hospital or in a conference room or something, they're outdoors, they're learning a new skill. We teach them about the bugs and the knots, and we have casting sessions. And on the last day of the retreat, we actually take them fishing for 3 hours. We do have a psychosocial session at the retreat and a medical session at the retreat, but it's not all about that. We just introduce them to something new, and they're out in nature with other women.
Miskin adds, learning proper fly fishing technique can sometimes be frustrating, but she adds that under these circumstances, it can also serve as a welcome distraction.
It's amazing the number of women that will come to us after a retreat and say, this is the first time I haven't thought about breast cancer, because they're so focused on learning how to tie that knot, or learning the difference between a nymph and a dry fly, or watching the riffles and the seams in the water. So I never really encounter frustration in women. Again, they've never fly fished for the most part, and they understand that we don't expect them to be master casters when they get through our retreats either.
Casting for Recovery is holding its national fundraiser in Hamilton on October 4th and 5th. It's called Cast One for Hope and is a single fly tournament. Each contestant gets just one fly to use for the day. If that fly gets lost or becomes unusable, the contestant is out of the running for the longest lasting fly, but can continue fishing for fun and additional prizes. Peg Miskin says there are different registration options.
Correct. It's $1,000 to be an angler in a boat. That includes a drift on the Bitterroot with your guide, lunch, of course, and both the Friday and Saturday night gathering. And then people can sign up just for the Friday night gathering, which is at a lovely home here in Hamilton. And we will have beer provided by Bitterroot Brewery, and Whistling Andes Distillery will be sampling as well at the Friday night event. That is $50. Saturday evening, folks can attend just a celebration dinner at the gorgeous Stock Farm Club down here, and that will include dinner and cocktails and silent and live auction.
And the non-angler Saturday night dinner on October the 5th costs $100. For more information, visit castoneforhope.org.
The Berkeley Pitt Public Education Committee has launched a website to continue its efforts to educate residents about the management of the former open pit copper mine in Butte that is now a Superfund site. The website, www.pittwatch.org, includes background information on environmental issues related to the Berkeley Pit and its toxic metal-laden water. The Montana Standard reports the site also offers scientific information, technical and legal documents that govern Berkeley Pit management, links to other groups and agencies involved in cleanup, frequently asked questions, and more. Visitors can also submit questions. The committee's work is funded by Atlantic, Richfield, and Montana Resources as part of their responsibilities under the Superfund listing. The committee has published print editions of Pit Watch since 1994.
International law expert Ved Nanda says the U.S. cannot isolate itself from the rest of the world without risking its own security. Nanda is a law professor and head of the Ved Nanda Center for International and Comparative Law at the University of Denver. He is also past president of the World Jurist Association, former U.S. delegate to the World Federation of the United Nations Association in Geneva, and is a council member for the American Bar Association section of international law. Nanda was in Missoula recently to deliver the annual Browning Lecture at the University of Montana's Law School. He also sat down with News Director Sally Mock to talk about the U.S. reaction to the use of chemical weapons in Syria, a use that violated international law.
Because there are treaties pertaining to chemical weapons, and what Assad did, is unacceptable in the international arena. He had not signed that treaty, but now he's willing to sign, and he's willing to have all those weapons that have been prohibited and treaty says that there must not be any production, and if there is any, they ought to be destroyed. So he has now said that he's going to destroy all those chemical weapons.
Of course, he's saying that after the U.S. threatened a military intervention.
Those sanctions are the ones that work. If there had been no threat, he would not have done that.
So what does that say about the ability of international treaties to be enforced if it requires a military threat versus the UN saying?
But the UN could not act because Russia and China are there at the Security Council to veto it. And if the Security Council is paralyzed, then the United Nations has no enforcement mechanism of its own. And therefore, the only way that you can possibly take care of it is if like-minded countries can threaten by the use of force. And in this instance, as you remember, Putin had from the very beginning said that he would not permit any United Nations action taken against Assad.
But he has agreed and actually has been key to there being some sort of solution proposed here, which may or may not work. We'll see.
Absolutely. As you rightly said, it may not work because destruction of those weapons is not that easy. It takes a very long period of time. And we don't even know how many places he has stored them. And he's trying even now to evade all that kind of responsibility. But I think Putin, Russia, they have gotten into this now, and therefore I think the hope is that perhaps there'll be some reality to it. The issue that's really important, Syria, is, as you know, there are 6 million displaced people, 100,000 plus dead, death and destruction, 6 million displaced, 1 million of them children, not going to school, malnourished, and people who are out of their homes. This is a catastrophe because humanitarian crisis of that sort we haven't seen in some time.
There's great debate, and you've written about it, Dr. Nanda, over whether the U.S. should be more isolationist, whether it should continue to be the, quote, policeman of the world and so on. And Syria certainly brings that into focus. And there are certainly people who can make the argument that unless the U.S. has a direct security interest, why get involved? And your answer to that is?
My answer to that is that our own security is tied with the security of the world.
Which is what the president
says.
At the
present time, terrorism knows no boundaries. At the present time, threats to us are not simply from other countries in that sense, but there are sectarian, there are religious conflicts all around. And if we consider ourselves to be an island and be in prosperity when the rest of the world suffers, that doesn't happen anymore. In this era of globalization, in this era of distances having shrunk, we are an interdependent world. And at the same time, the United States has had its own values, and those values are that we are part of humanity. And if the U.S. does not take action at this stage, nobody is able to do that.
Is that action, though, that we take necessarily going to achieve those goals? Because certainly you can point to the wars, the long wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and many people ask, what did that accomplish?
They didn't accomplish much. And I think you are absolutely right in saying that action that has to be taken has to be wise. Action that is taken has to be with foresight. And action that has to be taken has to be in our interest and in the interest of the international community. Now, the action that we took in Iraq is not the action that we needed to have taken. Afghanistan, I think initially when we went in, because bin Laden was there, Taliban were there, what they were doing was absolutely unacceptable. And at that time, our going in was fine. But then we directed our attention to Iraq. We practically gave up on Afghanistan, and Afghanistan is again in ruins. And both of those wars are the ones that make people war weary, and that is what you said earlier. People become isolationists. They ask a question, what is in it for us? Why should we be the world's policemen? And the point is that there is at least some moral responsibility on our part, being at this stage the only superpower left. And that is really where the responsibility to protect. That is one thing that in 2005 so many world leaders at the United Nations had agreed to. And how to put it in practice at the present time is not an easy question. And so you are absolutely right in saying people who are weary are asking, why should we go there? Why should we take the lead?
You're an expert in international law. The laws exist because there needs to be some sort of agreement among governments of what is acceptable and what is not. But that doesn't apply to madmen and despots.
It doesn't. And that is why we need initially to prevent all kinds of conflicts. We need to provide countries some kind of capacity building efforts on their part. But if nothing happens, then I think as a last resort, we might have to use force. That force should be used under the auspices of the UN. But if UN is paralyzed, if regional bodies don't work, then I think I would have to argue, I'm not a warmonger, but I have to argue that we might have to take at times action that may be having use of force if a country is unable, unwilling, manifestly unwilling to take care of its own population, because even one death is more than what we should accept.
We have been speaking with Dr. Ved Nanda, who is an expert in international law and teaches law at the University of Denver. And Dr. Nanda, a pleasure to talk about these serious issues with you. Thank you so much.
It's my privilege. Thank you very much for the time and for having me.
And now for tonight's weather forecast for west of the Divide. Tonight, expect mostly cloudy skies with a chance of rain showers. Lows will be in the 30s to lower 40s. Tomorrow will be mostly cloudy with a chance of rain showers and highs in the mid-50s. For central Montana, a high wind warning is in effect tonight for the Rocky Mountain Front and Eastern Glacier. Tonight calls for partly cloudy skies with lows around 35 to 45 degrees. Tomorrow, expect partly cloudy skies. Rain showers are likely as well. Highs around 55 to 65 degrees. And for southwest Montana, tonight will be cloudy with lows around 35 to 45 degrees. Tomorrow will also be cloudy with rain showers likely and highs around 55 to 65 degrees. And now for the editorial comments of Tom Power.
Many decades ago, concerns about the impact of industrial developments on rural areas led economists to develop a set of tools so that communities and governments could evaluate what the net benefits associated with those industrial developments would be after both the obvious and not so obvious benefits and costs were taken into account. Citizens and governments recognize that economic change rarely presents us with a pure free lunch. That is, pure benefits without any significant costs are almost never found in the real world. A major industrial development is likely to require the extension of public infrastructure to the new facilities, increase the wear and tear on existing roads, add new sources of air and water pollution, expand the need for police and fire protection, and so on. In addition, the families of the in-migrating workforce need schools for their kids, a broad array of social services, and would also add to the burden on public infrastructure. Of course, the new industrial development would also pay taxes, as would the additional workforce, and there would be additional economic activity that would also help fund expanded government services. The interesting question is what the net impact is likely to be after these additional benefits and additional costs are taken into account. Would the net impact be positive or negative? That is what economic impact analysis was supposed to puzzle out for us. Something changed over the years as the companies proposing new industrial developments took to sponsoring the economic impact analysis of their own projects. Not surprisingly, the analysis shifted to focusing only on the benefits of the proposed development. We exited real-world economics where benefits and costs always have to be weighed and evaluated, and entered a newly discovered fairyland of fantasy where there are only benefits. Industrial developers and their allies began to manufacture a world of pure benefits and endless free lunches. Recently, however, some of the most avid promoters of industrial development in any situation stumbled over economic reality. At the Montana Economic Development Summit in Butte last week, instead of the usual presentation of the oil boom in the Bakken area of eastern Montana as a gusher of wealth, high-paid jobs, and floods of money, we were told that to maintain that expanded economy, the Montana state government would have to fund a major expansion of basic infrastructure to the tune of tens, if not hundreds, of millions of dollars. Schools had to be expanded or new ones built. Roads had to be improved and maintained under the heavier traffic. Sewer and water systems and affordable housing had to be built. As the spokesperson for the Montana Contractors Association said, quote, "We think the state of Montana has an obligation to provide some infrastructure for these rural communities. We cannot expect corporations to invest capital here if there is no place for their employees to live, no place for them to flush their toilets, and no place for their kids to go to school," unquote. An engineering firm working in the Bakken also emphasized that additional government investment was necessary to sustain the boom. Quote, "People are coming in here and want a life. We need to plan for the new challenging workforce that's coming in, the new dynamic. We need to look at ways to make sure that we can keep them there so that industry can continue to grow," unquote. During the recent session of the Montana legislature, a bill was submitted to increase the state's investment in public infrastructure in the Bakken. It was passed by the legislature but vetoed by Governor Bullock, who said that the multimillion-dollar proposal was too costly for the state budget. This more recent discussion of the actual public costs associated with energy development in largely rural areas stands in stark contrast to the various economic impact analyses that have been released by energy developers in Montana in recent years. Those energy industry reports have continued to paint the fairyland free lunch picture. For instance, Arch Coal released an economic impact analysis of its proposal to develop the Otter Creek Coal in the Tongue River Valley and build a railroad line through the valley to facilitate the export of the coal. As we have come to expect, Arch's study of economic impacts found only benefits. Electric utilities upset over EPA's proposals to impose more limits on the pollutants from the Colstrip power plants also funded an economic impact analysis to sing the praises of the angelic performance of one of the largest emitters of air pollution west of the Mississippi. That economic impact analysis also found only benefits and no costs worth mentioning associated with the operation of those coal-fired electric generators. Of course, none of this fairyland economics is actually surprising. Industrial developers and their allies have become the sole sponsors of these types of one-sided economic analyses. They have turned the critical economic analysis that once sought to determine what the net balance of benefits and costs was into a public relations whitewash effort devoid of any critical weighing of benefits and costs. That is the song sung before the industrial development takes place. After it is in place, an entirely different song gets sung, one arguing that taxpayers and the government have to chip in to cover the very predictable costs or to forgive the corporation's obligations to meet environmental and other standards. This is not surprising behavior on the part of industrial developers. What is surprising is that we listen to these appeals with serious, straight faces and then let them get away with it.
Tom Power is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition. The views expressed do not necessarily represent those of the station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtpr.org or on Montana Public Radio's Facebook page. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Connor Valentine.
And I'm Courtney Anderson. Thanks for listening, and please join Edward O'Brien tomorrow at 7, 8, and 8:30 for Montana Morning News.